back for another edition of the SAFTAcast with yours truly, Scott C. I say boom boom. Now let me hear you say wow. Thank you. Folks, we got a lot to talk about here, and we got a great show lined up for you. Let me tell you about some stuff coming up, though, from Sundress Academy for the Arts and Sundress Publications here in the next month. There's a flurry of activity happening. May 25th at 3 p.m. at the Birdhouse in Knoxville, Tennessee, the SAFTA Reading Series arrives once again, this time welcoming guests Leanne Hornfelt and Chris McCurry, two Kentucky writers visiting the Knoxville area for this one. Folks, if you are in the Knoxville area on May 25th around 3 p.m., you want to check this one out. It is going to be a blast. It is going to be great. Trust me on that one. May 31st is also right around the corner, a little bit, a few more days than the 25th. But on May 31st, the Writing and Cooking of the South workshop will be happening with Sundress Academy at the Sundress Academy at Firefly Farms just outside of Knoxville, Tennessee. This is going to be a day-long Southern extravaganza. First, there's a workshop on Southern writing. What the hell is it? And how do you incorporate elements of Southern history and Southern mythos into writing, be it poetry or fiction or even nonfiction? Then afterwards, to celebrate your writing accomplishments and learning and your knowledge gaining, there will be a killer Southern cooking demonstration done by the ladies of Sundress, because all of them are Southern ladies from Louisiana, South Carolina, Mississippi, and Tennessee, and it is, oh man, if you've never had the home cooking that Sundress can lay down, you will be not disappointed. Trust me on this one. There will be a cooking demonstration, you'll learn how to cook Southern dishes, and then partake in a three-course Southern home-style dinner that evening. Lord have mercy! For more information, of course, you can check again Facebook.com, and you can go to Sundress Academy for the Arts, search it out, like the page, learn about it. You can also check them out at Sundress Publications. One more reminder for you, folks. I know I've been talking about this the last couple of episodes, but if this is your first time joining us, welcome. And now let me tell you about the inaugural undergraduate writing retreat from June 13th through the 15th at Firefly Farms in Knoxville, Tennessee. It is a three-day, two-night camping trip and poetry workshop led by nationally renowned poets Aaron Elizabeth Smith, T.A. Noonan, and Rhonda Lott. I'll be there as well, though I'm not on the bill and I'm not leading the workshop, but I will be in attendance there. This is going to be amazing, folks. 3 days, two nights, camping and learning about poetry and writing poetry and talking about it. $200 gets you in. Now, I know you're balking at there, $200, but understand that includes all meals as well as transportation to and from the Knoxville airport if you are coming from outside the Tennessee area. Camping gear is available for rent at the farm if you need it. If you come into town without it, that's okay. Space is limited, though. I will tell you that right now. Space is limited. The number of people going to this right now who have signed up are more than one, but less than 10, meaning that you've got less than 10 chances to be a part of this. And if you want to be a part of something, you want to be on the ground floor, so to speak, of something amazing, then you want to get in on this one. I'm serious. This is going to be amazing. For more information, of course, you can check again Facebook.com, and you can go to Sundress Academy for the Arts, search it out, like the page, learn about it. You can also check them out at Sundress Publications. Hey, speaking of social media, did you know that the SAFTAcast has a Twitter? It does indeed. If you are not part of the Twitter community, you can see all of our postings and our tweets, as the kids call them, on the SAFTAcast website there on the right. We put up a nice little feed of them. But if you are part of Twitter, We ask you, be nice to us. Give us a follow if you'd like. We'd like to hear from you. We'd like to hear your feedback on this program. Your feedback is always welcome. Speaking of people who are on Twitter, the one and the only Jordan D. White is on Twitter. And folks, let me tell you about today's show. I was looking forward to this interview for a while, and it did not disappoint. Jordan D. White is on the program. Let me go down the list real quick. Associate editor at Marvel Comics. Accomplished musician. Accomplished writer. Script writer. Comedian. Podcaster, all around good guy, and it was a blast having him on the program. We go back to our undergrad college days. We were in the radio station at Binghamton University together. We were in the local Rocky Horror cast together, and it was a delight having him on the program. We talk a little bit of shop, so to speak, about Marvel and what does it mean to be an associate editor, and how do great characters come about. So it's a little bit more work talk than usual on the program, but we were just so fascinated by talking about it because it's a world I don't know that well, beyond being a nerd about comics and such. And then, of course, there is your usual SAFTAcast stuff where we talk about random stuff, like the fact that I've been in Florida for 4 years and Disney World's only a few hours from where I live and I have yet to go. I went when I was a teenager, but I haven't gone since, all right? And Jordan, of course, tries to convince me. If I do go back, I will tell you about it on this program. As always, folks, I tell you a lot on this program, and I tell you that today's episode is good. And if you like this show, Please, tell a friend about it. But first, I'm going to tell you that there's a theme song to hit you with.
Hello there.
Hey, Jordan. How you doing, man?
Good. How are you?
Hey, great. It's been a long time since I've chatted with you, actually.
Yeah, it's been quite a while.
When was the last time I saw you? Do you remember?
Well, yeah, you guys came to New York one time, and I met you in the
burger joint on the outside the theater district, I think it was.
Is that true?
Yeah, I think that's where we went, because I remember there were burgers involved, and I remember we had a conversation about burgers, so.
I'll believe that.
I'll believe it, too. It was somewhere off the theater district, because it was you know, the beauty of New York is that you're walking one block, and you're in one neighborhood, and the next you're in another neighborhood completely.
Yeah, I think we met up at Grand Central, and then we walked over.
Yeah.
To somewhere.
Yeah, we walked over somewhere because I remember there were a lot of restaurants on the street and we were all kind of mystified by that, those of us who weren't New York
natives.
Yes,
we went to Five Napkin, didn't we?
Yeah, it was Five Napkins. I think that was the name of it.
Yes.
Yeah, it was pretty cool. I remember that. Yeah, it was a very tasty meal. So how have you been recently, man?
I've been good. I mean, you know.
What's going on that makes you say, uh-oh? You know, it sounds like good butt right there.
No, just a lot of work, just a lot of craziness, you know. I mean, nothing crazy in my personal life, really.
Isn't really about your personal life. We're not going to get too intimate in the details and everything.
Are we already recording?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know we were on. I thought we were just chatting.
Yeah, that's exactly what the show is, man. It's basically a chat show, you know?
Okay.
It's two people getting reminiscing or whatever over coffee or, you know, whatever. I don't have any coffee right now, but it's kind of late for me.
I don't really have coffee either.
Yeah, I can't remember if you're a coffee person or not.
No, not really.
We'll imagine a refreshing beverage of your choice then.
Coke Zero, I'll go with.
Okay, you go with Coke Zero. That's fine. I used to hate Coca-Cola, like any variant of it other than the main one. And then I moved to the South. You would not believe the drink of the South is not sweet tea. It is Diet Coke.
Did you know that Diet Coke is not Coke with artificial sweeteners? It's a totally different soda.
I did not know that. No.
Yeah. In fact, New Coke?
Yeah.
New Coke is actually Diet Coke with like corn syrup instead of artificial sweeteners.
Really? That's what it was?
Yeah. Because it was just, and it just tested better in the taste tests. Whereas I believe Coke Zero is Coca-Cola with artificial sweeteners.
I wouldn't know. I finally had Mexican Coke, though, at New Year's this year.
Oh, with real sugar?
Yeah.
Nice.
Wow. It was like a big difference. I can see why all the hipsters are fond of it right now.
Yeah, I haven't had the Coke one, but I've had the Pepsi, whatever they call it, Pepsi Throwback.
I've had that, too. I got that, and I was surprised because I had a drink of it, and I looked at my wife, and I was like, this is what I remember it being when I was a kid. And I just recently tried the Mountain Dew throwback, and that didn't impress me.
I don't think I ever drank Mountain Dew when I was young.
If I did, I don't remember it. But I do remember Pepsi as a kid.
For sure.
I think it's interesting. This is fascinating. Are you, you know, you prefer Coke Zero, that's what you're having right now. Do you prefer Coke or Pepsi overall?
Coke, definitely.
Interesting. Because you're from Connecticut and you know, you live in New York City. Most of us Northerners, we're from Pepsi country.
Really?
Yeah. You come down South. Everybody, like all my friends down South think I'm weird because I prefer to buy Pepsi over a Coke product.
No, I've just always been big on Coke. I can't believe we're talking about Coke versus Pepsi.
Well, all right. Let's just agree. They both, in the words of Bloom County, taste like malted battery acid.
Sure, that is pretty true.
And they're going to kill us in the end anyway, so, you know.
Oh, absolutely.
It doesn't matter.
Chemicals are good. Go ahead.
No,
I said chemicals are good.
Chemicals are good. You know, hooray for chemicals, you know? As long as
I don't know. Chemicals can be good in some respects, yes, pharmaceuticals. But, you know, you're married to a physician. You understand the need for chemicals. It's good stuff, you know.
There you go. Yeah.
So you're saying things are busy at work these days. And, yes. You know, that I can only imagine what it's like to work not only for a comic book company, but I would argue, and I would say, and this is not, you know, I'm not promoting it or anything. I'm just saying I would argue the number one, at least the most visible brand in the industry.
It's definitely, we're definitely the number one comic company in the United States. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you could say worldwide, just because there certainly are some big comic companies over in Europe and in Asia as well. But absolutely for certain, in the United States, we are the number one comic company.
Yeah, I don't know how you guys test in Japan when you're up against like Clamp and such over there.
Right. I don't know the figures of how we measure up against that.
Definitely, but in America, though.
In America, yeah, like. You know, once in a while, in the charts that they release, like DC will beat us for a month or something. But generally speaking, we come out on top, like maybe 10 to 11 months of the year, if not 12.
It's only when, say, DC pulls some stunt or something.
Sure, exactly.
And they get noticed for that. Like, there was something recently that they were pulling the suicide of Harley Quinn, and that backfired on them.
No, that's actually totally not true. Not that I want to spend my time defending DC, but that's not what happened.
Okay.
What happened is they did a comic about Harley Quinn where they said there was going to have a bunch of different artists in it, and they said, in addition, it could be you in this comic doing a page of it. So here's the script for the one other page, and you know, go draw it. And if you draw it the best, it'll be in the comic. Now, if you actually read that page in the context of the comic, it is Harley is making jokes about suicide because she's on a team called the Suicide Squad.
Okay.
So I'm on a team called the Suicide Squad. What should I be, killing myself all the time? And so there's like jokes about her killing herself. Not a great PR move to have
that particular page or panel.
Exactly. It wasn't the best choice, but they weren't. She didn't really kill herself, and they weren't really talking about her killing herself. They were just a cheesy joke.
But it did backfire on them as a PR thing. I saw that happen. A lot of mockery on the internet.
For sure.
So it's things like that then that DC may beat you for a little bit, a couple weeks, a month or so.
Help them beat us. But they did a thing a couple years ago where they relaunched every single comic that.
Yeah.
At the same time, and that, you know, yes, they beat us.
I could see that happening. I don't keep up with comics that much. I know I have a surprising amount of knowledge of comics.
Sure.
But as a kid, I loved them. But as I got older, I shifted away from them. And then I go back to my one box of comics and went through them with a mutual friend of ours. And he was like, actually, none of these are worth anything. And so I kept a few sentimental ones and such. But other than that.
Unfortunately, I mean, the thing with regarding comics and value is that a lot of it is based on misconceptions. You know, in the 60s, people, you know, lots of people bought comics, but almost nobody kept them, and especially in good condition. So the fact that, you know, 80% of moms threw out those comics, that's why.
This is trash, you know.
Right. That's why the ones that still are in good condition from back then are worth something, because no one expected them to be.
Same goes for Mad magazines. Those early ones and in good condition can sell pretty decently on the market.
But then when you get to the 80s and especially the 90s,
when
people were looking at comics and buying them and going, oh, the comics that were bought in the 60s were worth something now, so therefore if I buy this in 20 years, it will be worth something.
Lousy baby boomers.
They were 100% wrong, because most of the people who bought them are keeping them well. Once everybody throws them away, gives up on them, the people who didn't throw them away and give up on them will have something worth something. But
basically what happened was there was this huge glut of them, and people bought into it and everything, like the Beanie Babies, and it just never materialized because there was just so much of it.
Right, exactly. For example, X-Men number one.
Mm-hmm.
Leave is the top selling comic of all time. I think it sold something in the realm of 7 million copies.
Really? Wow.
Yeah. Wait,
are we talking the original 60s X-Men, like the first issue?
No, I'm sorry. I'm talking about one from the 90s, drawn by Jim Lee.
Okay.
It had lots of different covers, but the biggest cover had a big giant fold out cover.
It's
like I said, 7 million copies. So as of right now, like there are enough copies
to keep the price down.
Yeah, everyone who cares can have like 10 copies. It's not.
It's like the death of Superman when DC pulled that, and you know, I remember I think there were like three different covers for the actual like early death ones, but.
What it looked like because it was in the black bag. I don't remember what the cover looks like.
I if I remember right, I'm trying to think now because I'm thinking of Superman Doomsday, the movie, the cartoon animated version they did is Doomsday's fist punching through the shield and blood on it. And I think I want to say the cover is the Iwo Jima image of the cape and shield across the flagpole.
Yeah,
in the ruins.
Right.
I still have the graphic novel collection of the three book cycle somewhere around here.
And that was the victim of like the twofold thing. First of all, just the general concept that they thought that the consumers thought, oh, this will be worth something in general because comics are worth something. And two, I guess at the time, and this is kind of staggers me to believe, but I guess at the time people actually thought, oh my God, they're killing Superman. He will never be back again.
Just a quick side note, has any comic book company ever truly killed off a character for good? Even DC just brought back the one Robin that everybody hated.
Right. I would say superhero-wise, I mean, because obviously we've done that with supporting characters. Uncle Ben has never really come back.
Has Gwen Stacy ever come back?
Again, never really.
Okay.
They've done like trickery where there was a clone or alternate realities or things like that.
But dream sequence.
Never the real Gwen Stacy really being back.
Okay.
Superhero wise, Captain Marvel, the one from the 70s, who was an alien named Mar-Vell, he died of cancer, pretty much has never come back. Again, they've done tricky things where they go, oh, is this him from the past? No, it's really a Skrull. Oh, is this him? No, it isn't. It's a trick. But the real Captain Mar-Vell has never come back. I think because they had him die of cancer, some sort of which is a obviously real and a serious issue. I think they didn't want to go. They haven't wanted to say, well, we fixed it. We fixed cancer.
Like Eddie Brock suddenly coming. You know, I was like, I had cancer. Now, oh, the symbiote has healed me for the most part.
Yeah, you know. Nah.
But anyway, Do you think when Stan Lee finally passes over, that they're going to retire a character?
No.
Because I know when, you know, the Muppets like, the Muppets kind of did that when Jim Henson died. Rolf was to never speak again, and he didn't until the most recent Muppet movie.
Oh, is that why Frank Oz was mad? I know he was mad at
them. No, he was mad about the fact that they were including fart jokes in the movie, believe it or not. He thought that was too low and too cheap for the Muppets.
Interesting.
I don't know. I kind of liked the film. I thought it was decent.
Yeah, I enjoyed the Muppets. It was just called the Muppets, right?
Yeah. It was a nice mix of for people like my age who grew up on them in the Henson era, the major Henson era, the mainstream era. But it's also a nice introduction for those who now have children.
Right. Yeah, I absolutely thought it was a good time. And I'm looking forward to the new one.
I'm wary.
A character, mostly because at this point, there's no one. I mean, again, he did work on all of the major characters, but there's nobody who's like, well, no one has ever done that character without him. For a while.
Well, newspaper Spider-Man kind of still relies on Stan.
Yeah, maybe.
Which I still think is one of the best comics in the daily paper. And this is not, you know, praising you all at Marvel or anything like that. Understand, you know, I just think it's a great strip because it's almost as if Stan Lee has a brain parasite at times in the story. Like, I pay attention to it. There was one last year where Spider-Man gets tricked into taking a poison gas or whatever that knocks him out. But the way he gets there is that two people on the street are like, Spider-Man, my child won't drink milk. Will you show him to drink milk? Because if he sees you drinking it, then he'll drink it. And so we have this great strip of Spider-Man drinking this kid's milk and handing it back to him. And I felt the parodies were wonderful that I saw on the net. You know, it's so surreal at times. I mean, this is a superhero who has actually gotten knocked out by a brick falling on his head.
Sure. Sure.
And right now we have J. Jonah Jameson going ballistic in the strip. You know, when this airs, it'll be a little bit late. But nonetheless, right now he's trying to try on Iron Man's original suit so that he can track down Spider-Man's heartbeat and reveal who he is.
Now, I have to confess, I don't keep up with the daily strip of Spider-Man. I'm assuming it's set in a more like classic status quo.
I don't know. I just know that it's kind of ridiculous at times, and it's so ridiculous that it's wonderful. It's
For example, J.J. Jameson is the publisher of the Daily Bugle in that, right?
Yeah, he still is, and Robbie Robertson is still his assistant, although he just quit Jonah's company in the Daily Bugle because Jonah's gone off the deep end.
Because, you know, in the comics, Jonah is actually the mayor of New York.
Oh, I did not know this. See, I'm out of touch with the current run of
He's currently the mayor of New York, which is also pretty cool.
Kind of evil and good at the same time. You know, it's almost like when Lex Luthor gets his brain transplanted into the young version with the red flaming hair and everything. And, you know, he looks cool. I can only imagine what he's like as mayor.
I mean, that's the thing. Jonah's a great character because... just so everybody knows, we're talking about J. Jonah Jameson from Spider-Man comics, who was played in the old Spider-Man movies by J.K. Simmons, if you remember that character.
And that was an excellent casting choice, in my opinion.
Great. What I love about that character is he's a character that I feel like really did kind of grow and evolve over the course of the series because he hates Spider-Man. So at the very beginning, he's definitely set up as just like kind of a blowhard who's angry all the time and yells, and he's not very... Peter, but you know, he does give him money because he hires him and stuff.
Yeah,
but like I feel like over the years you kind of get to know him better, and it's like he's not that bad of a guy. Like, he really does want what's best, and yes, he does every once in a while like create a spider slayer robot or fund the creation of a spider slaying robot that turns out to go crazy and like hurt lots of innocent people, but he does it with the best of intentions because he really doesn't trust Spider-Man. You know what I mean? He's not so bad.
It's like if we go on the D&D alignment scale, he's not diabolical evil by any means. He's more miscreant evil, if anything.
Yeah, yeah. So him as the mayor, like it's a giant pain in Spider-Man's butt most of the time. But it's like, you know, he means well.
He probably makes, you know, the sanitation good, and you know, I could see him bringing the porno theaters back to Times Square, you know, fixing a couple of things that Giuliani did.
are you pining for the porno theaters?
I am. I really am. Because by the time I made it to New York City from upstate New York, they were all gone. And the crazies were still there. And I do have a superhero story from New York. The first time I ever went was 96 or so. Like, I really went to New York. And admittedly, when you're on a class trip from upstate, you just go to Manhattan. So I'm walking down near Times Square, and this guy starts approaching us, and he's wearing a Superman costume. Okay. But here's the beauty of it. He does not look like Superman or Clark Kent by any means. And all he is doing is muttering the word pussy over and over and over.
Okay, so that's a crazy person, yeah.
Yes,
that's,
and it made me smile so much.
See, I'll be honest with you. I don't even think we get that anymore, because now...
Aww.
Now the superheroes in Times Square are jerky con artist people. They're not con artists. They're
people like, you know, here, pose with Spider-Man for $5.
Yeah, which I think is really, really scummy.
Mm.
Because I feel like it takes advantage of people. Because they're not, well, first of all, obviously they're not approved of by any of the companies who own the people that they're dressed like. Neglecting that entirely, They're not setting up in a way like going like, if you'd like to do this, here's how you do it. You come over to us, and they just are walking around and like going to children and being like, hey, children, so that the parents are like, oh, now
I have to do this.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I think it's real scummy.
It's not like a children's birthday party where you get somebody to dress up as, you know, Wolverine and come in and be like, hi, kids, you know, let's have a good time. That's a little bit different.
Right. Or even where you're going to an event where you're like, when you go to this event, you know, if you go to the mall, there's going to be a Santa Claus there, and you can get in the line and you can get your picture with him. Mm. It's not like that at all. It's like the free for all nature of like going pictures at Disney World, except again, you don't have to pay those people because you've already paid to get in.
And they're often a lot nicer too there.
Much nicer there.
I saw recent photos on Facebook of you. You went to Disney World recently.
I love Disney World. I mean, I do. You know, I do work for Marvel, which is owned by Disney, so I get, you know,
discount. You get mad discount. You know, we'll leave it at that.
But I also love it. We went to Disney World for our 5th anniversary, my wife and I, which was before I worked for Marvel. And Yeah, we do love it. We'll go back as often as we can afford to.
and it is pricey. You know, even you know, I live in Florida and I'm only two and a half hours down the road from it. But I'll tell you, in all the years I've been down here, I haven't gone.
Oh, you should go.
I know I should. There's a part of me that wants to because I did go as a child. You know, like when you live in New York, that's a huge thing. It's like, you're going there for Easter? Awesome. And I went to, first time I went, it was raining. Second time, it was really sunny and we had a good time. But I'm worried about it now that I'm in my 30s. Am I going to still enjoy it?
I would say yes. I mean, again, I've been there twice in my 30s and once in my late 20s. And we don't have children and we just went and had a blast. And it's terrific. Two parts. First of all, you can just go and do whatever you want. And, I don't know, just have fun. That Star Tours is so cool. There's so much.
They still have Star Tours?
Not only do they still have it, it's way better than it used to be.
Really? Because I went on it when it was in the first incarnation of it.
They've souped it up. It's 3D now.
Whoa.
Has multiple versions. So you go in and it like gives you like a randomized thing made up of like sections. Also, it has instead of, no offense to Paul Rubens, but instead of the robot voiced by Paul Rubens flying your ship, now you your ship flown by C-3PO. Thank you very much.
Okay, that's a little bit better, although we will not argue. I don't think either of us could argue the point of Paul Rubens as the navigator in Flight of the Navigator, as the computer.
Paul Rubens is great in general.
And I agree. And I don't know. I saw him do the Pee-wee thing recently and try and bring it back. And I don't know. If, you know, nothing against Paul. He can still do it. He proved that. Mm-hmm. But I don't know if he holds in a world like in our current world and culture.
You know, it's just, I don't know. It's tough. I definitely still enjoy it, but I don't know if it's because I enjoyed it back in the day.
Yeah, and that's the problem with nostalgia, I find. I have what's called the ALF principle of nostalgia, where I test everything along what happened when I watched ALF as an adult, which is ALF is still funny. There's still some good jokes on it.
Are you serious?
Yeah, there's still some good jokes. There's one episode... There's an old episode where he's stuck in a hotel room with nothing but a toaster, and he just keeps making toast because it's a talking toaster, and it'll say toast, toast down, toast up, and he's fascinated with this. So they come back to the hotel room, and it's filled with toast, and he's just giggling like a maniac.
I'm shocked that ALF is still good. ALF is definitely a show I haven't watched.
It holds, but I recently. You know, when I was a kid, I was huge into He-Man. I don't know why.
Don't go back. Don't go back.
I tried.
Oh.
I tried 10 minutes of one episode, and all I could think of is, why the fuck did I watch this?
Yeah, that's all you can take. 10 minutes is it.
I can't handle it.
I had a friend who was very into He-Man when we were young. And at some point, it was actually a while ago now. So it was because we rented it on videotape from a store. But we were way too old for it. And I made him turn it off after 5-10 minutes. I was like, this is the worst thing I've ever seen. I can't believe we watched it.
Something happens to us as adults. We become a little bit cynical about it. And we realize this is just a giant toy marketing ad here.
I don't even think it's just the cynicism, because I feel like you can do a giant toy marketing ad that's still watchable.
Example, Marvel. I'm just kidding. No, I mean, you got to be fair, though. I mean, you guys at Marvel are like, you know, with the help of Disney, you can't argue with the fact that Disney's got your back on things.
Sure. I mean, well, yeah.
Put it in Star Wars context, I was actually happy about the acquisition 2 years ago, because you've got this franchise. It's gigantic. When Lucas goes on to the Force and absorbs into it, who's going to take care of the legacy then? Who's got the clout and the power to do it?
Sure.
And same with the Muppets. I understand.
In addition, I mean, well, the difference there being between Marvel and Lucasfilm is Marvel. Again, this is not me talking as a representative of Marvel or Disney.
Right.
Me just talking as someone who's looking at the way
this
things
is your personal
are.
Opinion of things.
Yeah. Like Marvel, you know, but on both sides was just doing what they're doing. And then Disney was like, we love what you're doing. We want you to be part of us and keep doing that. So like, you know, we were making lots of comics. We're still doing that. It hasn't really changed the way we do.
Yeah, I've noticed that too, except for maybe in the movies now they have to put the Disney Buena Vista logo in there.
Right. But right. Because that's like a corporate thing, but that's not like,
right.
it didn't change the way they make movies. You know what I mean? They were already kicking out all these great movies being distributed through whoever. Was it Paramount before? I forget. And now they're just still doing that, but now they're doing it with Disney. And I'm sure that on some level there's more people consulting on about something or other. But for the most part, it was like, yes, we like what you're doing. Keep doing it.
I haven't seen much of a change, honestly. I saw the trailer for Winter Soldier, the new Captain America, and it looks, you know, the standard fare in terms of quality and such for me.
Whereas, say, if you look at Lucasfilm, it's a big change. Of philosophy of what they're doing in the sense that before it was George Lucas going, here's what I want to do. I want to do this. And then they do that, you know,
right.
And whether that be like, okay, they did a couple of movies and then they went many years and they didn't do movies. And then it's like, I'd like to do a few more movies. And they did some more movies. Whereas now, as soon as Disney got control, they went,
okay, we got to have a strategy.
Exactly. We love Star Wars. We're going to make a Star Wars movie every year. Go.
Yeah. And they've set up that strategy, and they jettisoned LucasArts, the video game arm, for the most part. The logo is still used for a couple of like phone apps and such, but for the most part, the video game company's out. And it was a very sad thing for many people like me who follow video games, who go, oh, you guys put out some really good titles. You got nothing to be ashamed of.
Yeah, I remember playing Full Throttle. I'm not a big video
game. Oh, yes.
I remember that game from back in the day, and I enjoyed it. I remember the big thing of that being it had a... I forget the word for it, but they had developed a new a way of doing the soundtrack such that the music doesn't just cut off.
Yeah. It
like adapt to what you're doing. And it was like, oh, wow.
It's like, interesting. Now, they published some really good games over the years. So let me ask you, Jordan, let's talk about comics for a little bit.
Let's do it.
All right. So you're an associate editor at Marvel, which basically means I know the difference as an educator. I know the difference between assistant and associate. Basically means you've got tenure for life, basically. You know?
No.
Okay.
Not so, tenure for life.
Okay, so. But let's, Marvel,
there's a couple of levels of in the editorial. There's assistant editor, which is the newest, which is the newest person there, you know.
Low level on the totem pole.
Right. Low on the totem pole. And they typically, an assistant editor is most of the time only going to be working with a full editor on their books. So it'll be an assistant editor assisting an editor.
Right. You're learning the business, basically.
Right. And mostly. Now, over time, though, the young editors get to start taking on more responsibility. So even when I was an assistant editor, I started having books of my own that I could edit myself.
Okay.
And then associate editor is typically the step between assistant editor and editor, where you're editing more and more of your own books, and hopefully, if the opportunities are that it arises, assisting on less and less things. So at this point in my career, I am mostly editing my own books, and there's a few books where I help out a little bit. But even that, I have kind of dialed back more recently.
Understood.
I've been getting more and more of my own stuff to do.
Okay. So
an editor doesn't assist anybody. They work on their own and hopefully have an assistant. And then there's a senior editor way up top, but that's,
yeah. And that's at the end of your career kind of thing. Now that's the head level. So like, do they go through like a process to evaluate? Okay. The time has come. We got to evaluate. What have you been doing and such? Now you go on to associate.
It's definitely more mysterious than that.
Okay, because I you don't have to reveal any trade secrets. It's just I'm trying to put my finger on it because I just went through a process of going through promotion in academia from assistant to associate, and it's a huge thing.
There's no formal process.
Okay,
there's no like this is how you do it. It kind of just happens. You know, you do your best work, and hopefully, if you do well enough, they'll like it,
and they're like, okay,
yeah,
okay.
I like to think I'm on track to become a full editor relatively
down the road.
I have a lot of book. Like I said, I have a lot of stuff on my own. I edit right now. I edit Deadpool. I edit a number of Deadpool side projects, including the Infinite comic that's going now, including a bunch of miniseries that are happening. I edit Thunderbolts. I edit X-Factor. And then coming up, I'm going to be editing. Did we announce this yet?
I don't know.
I'm going to be editing something really big and awesome.
Okay, we'll leave it at that.
But
we'll keep
really,
our eyes open.
Really awesome, yeah.
So let me ask you then, that's about four or five books or four or five titles and lines.
Yeah.
Not including the side projects. Let's just leave it at Deadpool, Thunderbolts, X-Factor, and a one that's coming down the pike.
Yes, the one that, yeah.
So let's say three or four. How do you keep that all straight in your head? Like, you know, you're saying you can't be just sitting there going, "Wait a minute, wait, no, Deadpool doesn't have adamantium claws. What the hell am I thinking?"
Well, hopefully, I just know that sort of thing because I just have read enough about it. Yeah. I mean,
do you keep like a color coded system or something for yourself to keep reminding yourself? Oh yeah, this one is the one I'm working on for this.
No, mostly I just juggle all that information in my head. To be totally honest with you.
Oh, okay.
I do. I mean, I have one spreadsheet where I have deadlines, and those deadlines are color coded. But like, you know, when people's things are due, and it's like, oh, you know, Deadpool stuff is in red, and this person, the Thunderbolts, is in orange, and et cetera. Okay. But
do you get to yell at people for not making their deadline or getting very close, and you're like, where is it?
Yeah, I mean, I
do you get to be Joe Jen? Do you get to be JJJ?
No, I mean, yes, I could. But that's not my style. I'm not a JJ. I'm more of a Robbie, you know.
Okay. I was like, okay, you know, come on. I need this. You know, this is serious here.
Counting on you.
If you don't, I am going to hit you with a very small object in multiple places.
No, see, I'm much more likely to just be disappointed in the person than I am to be.
And that can work to your advantage. You know, some of the, you know, I'm disappointed in you can be some of the most devastating words to someone.
I mean, one of the things I joke about at work is that I am a minute Hulk, because I can get very mad very quickly, but it goes away very quickly as well.
And then it's gone.
Just like, no, motherfucker, what the fuck?
All right. Oh, what the? Oh, okay. I'm cool. I got my Coke Zero. I'm cool. All back. So let me ask you, Jordan, how did you start in this business? I know, you know, you and I go back to our college days together, so we have a bit of a history. And I know you're a comic fanatic basically since childhood, I'm guessing.
Mm-hmm.
So how did you end up working for Marvel?
I just wanted it bad enough. No, basically what happened was, I've always loved comics. There was a couple of years where I stopped reading comics. And then thankfully, when I started, when I started dating the woman who became my wife, she was also into comics, and we both like fed each other's comic addiction majorly. And so we both ended up reading way more than we did separately together, which is the opposite of what most people experience. They get together with a wife who's not into comics, and they go,
or a husband or whatever, and your passion dies.
Well, wait, that made it sound really bad.
What? I mean, sometimes it happens.
You get married, and then their passion dies.
And then the passion dies.
Well, thankfully, that's not what happened for me.
Usually babies are also involved in the process.
And the fact that we don't have children probably...
I used to enjoy playing video games. Then the kid came along.
Right. So when we got together, I started reading more and more comics, and I did. I love them. And I went through college. I finished undergrad. I got married, and I went back to grad school. And to be honest with you, I think large amount of why I'm able to work at Marvel is WHRW Binghamton. Because it's the radio station where you and I met.
Yep.
Well, we spent a lot of time anyway. I think we met before that. Because it's a free format radio station. And while I was doing, you know, English and creative writing and stuff like that in my classes, going to that radio station and being able to do whatever I wanted, I said, well, what I want to do is I want to make comics, but I can't do that on a radio. So I want to tell stories.
You could. This would be very interesting. It's a very visual medium.
Right. Yeah. You know, you can't quite do a comic book, but I could do adventure stories in the radio. So I started all the radio serials, which I know you are very familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them about superheroes, some of them about just like time travel and science heroes and all sorts
very
of things.
Very comic book element.
Right. Exactly. Because ideally I would like to be making comic books, and I was drawing at the same time before I did the radio serials, I was drawing my own comics, but they were mostly horror comics because I'm not a very good artist, and I can draw a bunch.
So the art was the horror.
No. Hopefully it was not terrible. But I was like, I can draw a bunch of like average, you know, college students get killed, but I can't like buff superheroes fighting. Like
Fair enough. You can't pull off a Rob Liefeld.
No, no.
Sorry, for those of you who don't know, basically just picture Cable with a lot more pouches than he already has, and improbable chest.
So I wanted to make these stories, and once I had the radio show where mm-hmm. we were doing the radio serials, it became very much a similar job to what I'm doing in that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, except that I was also writing a lot more back then. I was writing a number of them, but the ones that I wasn't writing, I was farming out to other writers saying, I need you to write this. And then when they would give it back, I'd go like, okay, here's my notes on it. Like, I think we need to do this in order to make it fit with the story better. And, mm-hmm. and wrangling a bunch of people to work on a project together and doing it all on a deadline so that we could get that show on the air every week.
Yeah.
It's actually very similar to what I do every day now.
Yeah, I was going to actually ask you, you know, for the benefit of our listeners who don't know what it's like to work in a major company like this, you know, the number one brand, so to speak, the most visible. What is the daily job for you, really? I mean, how does it go to print and all that?
Sure. I mean, I would say if you what an editor's job in the comics industry, or at least at Marvel, is to work with the creators of the comic at every level of the creation of the comic to make sure that the comic occurs in a timely fashion and is good when it gets done.
Okay.
So we'll start, you know, usually the earliest process of a comic is either the casting of the comic, meaning deciding who's going to be working on it, or conversely, if it comes the other way, the pitching of the comic, where we're working with a writer to say we want to do this comic and convincing the rest of editorial that it's worth doing.
Okay.
So let's say typically the casting of a comic. So I've got a comic. It's called Deadpool. I need to go. Well, who would be a good writer for Deadpool? And I'll think about that. And then I'll approach a writer and say, hey, I'm interested in having you write Deadpool. What kind of ideas do you have? And they'll shoot me some ideas.
Okay.
Or to me, depending on the situation, it could be different. They'll shoot some. So let's say they write up some ideas, and I go, okay, they sent me 4 story ideas. This one I think is really strong. I think we can do this story.
Okay.
Then we'll go back and forth like that a bit. They'll probably do a longer outline. I'll read it. I'll say that this is a really good outline, but you know.
And you give your notes and ideas on it.
Sense if this happened, it would be this. Like, you know, and you know, I think this is where the issue break should be instead of there. Stuff like that. Then again, they'll keep doing that until they have a full script where I've given notes on the full script and it's approved.
Okay.
From there,
you sound like a corporate suit in some regards. That's the cynic in me coming from watching television and knowing that business and that industry. But basically, it's a back and forth thing until you hammer out, okay, here's the general arc we want to go for. Here's where the issue breaks are going to happen, etc.
Yeah, I mean, kind of like an executive producer more than a suit, because I'm not really I'm not the guy at the network going, nah, like we don't like your show.
You're not one of those that comes along and is like, change this because we got to fix it for the ratings.
Well, if I have to. Someone puts something that's not ratings appropriate. Yeah. But I mean, I think I'm more the executive producer who's getting scripts from the writers of the show going, oh, this is pretty good.
And you greenlight it then.
Right. And then you work with the next. So then again, then I give the script to the penciler. We work on the same thing.
Okay.
I'll see the art as it comes in and go, that looks great. Oh, hang on, this doesn't look good. You know, do this better.
This is really confusing.
Do it better.
I understand why you want to put Squirrel Girl in the very background there for the fans, but no, it doesn't work here. No.
Then the inker, then the colorist, and at the same time as the colorist is working, typically the letterer is working, and then we'll bring it all together and give final notes with the writer saying, you know, on the physical one going like, okay, this line, now that it's with the art, it doesn't sound right. Like maybe try this and mm-hmm. do that with the writer as well. And then we'll lock it down and we send it off to the printer. So mm-hmm. I would say soup to nuts, that whole process probably takes somewhere in the realm of a range of 4 to 2 months, depending on how much time you've got.
So that's how far you guys are thinking in advance.
Now, it's funny. You make it sound like that's far in advance. That's not very far in advance.
It is for the consumer who goes in and buys, you know, an issue. I don't know the schedule. I'm assuming 1 to 2 weeks they come out, you know, every one to two weeks.
No. They come out like once. Well, they come out once or twice a month.
Mm. So I know that recently in the comics, Deadpool got married.
He's not yet. But
it's going to happen. It's like a serious big thing I hear on the buzz and the grapevine and everything. But you guys were planning that out way back before Halloween then.
Yes. that's funny that you, that's I, like, it kind of blows my mind that you think that's a long time because I feel like that's nothing. I mean, again, if you compare that to like television, they've got to plan things way further ahead than that. And, and like movies are in process for years.
Yeah.
Whereas I, to me, it's like, that's fast.
In poetry and fiction and everything. Yeah. It's very similar. Like Sundress, we're thinking already ahead into 2015 and everything. We've got schedules set up, but no, now that I think about it, you're right. It is a very fast turnaround by comparison.
I mean, yeah, on average, probably 3 months. And then now about that, though, what I should say is that's, like I said, from soup to nuts on one issue of a comic or one, you know, yeah, so one issue of a comic, let's say. Mm-hmm. But each editor is going to be working on like a zillion of those at the same time.
Okay. Because
in addition to the fact that I'm working on an issue of Deadpool, I'm not just working on an issue of Deadpool. I'm working on many issues because while I'm working with the writer on the issue that is just getting written, I'm working with the penciler on the one before that, and I'm working probably with the inker and the colorist on the one from before that.
So you're working on like three or four issues at a time of one title.
Minimum. Maybe more, because sometimes, because of, like I said, some comics do come out more than once a month. Deadpool, for example, ships, I believe, about 18 issues a year. Mm. And as a result, there's pretty much, I don't want to say no, but there's very few artists who can do 18 issues in a year.
I can't think of any.
Yeah, they're very uncommon. They're very uncommon. So, which means that we will have to have usually a couple of different artists working. So, as of right now, I have like three different pencilers penciling Deadpool comics at once. We're working on multiple arcs at the same time.
Mm.
We have a lot to, I mean, you mentioned how do you keep those things straight? And it's just
a juggling act.
Yeah. It's you know, plate spinning and all that stuff where you just have to, my wife used to play, these video games, and she probably still does, where they're like time management games. Like you run a cake shop and you have to make sure you have enough.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And then people come in with orders and you have to serve the orders at the time. And I she was playing those one time and I was like, I would never want to play that. Like, that's what I do all day. That's not what I want.
It's like I do that all day long. I don't need to come home and now worry about cakes, you know?
Right. Because that's what I'm doing. Like, I'm making sure that, I got this page in from one guy. I got to get it to this other guy. And I can't let anybody stop working because
you just yell to the bullpen, guys, I'm going for lunch. You go out there and you're like, I got to worry about the cakes now. Oh man, the cakes are really good. You don't even eat.
Right. I mean, it's that being said, it's the best because those things that I'm doing are reading stories and giving notes on stories that I care about, you know, and putting out.
You've grown. If you didn't enjoy them before, you've grown to enjoy.
Absolutely.
I mean, Deadpool's fairly recent in the comic book in the Marvel world by comparison to many, you know, people. You know, for example, we've known Wolverine's been around since, you know, a long time.
77, maybe?
Thereabouts. And I know that Spawn all that, you know, creates, we get Venom and such, and that's in the late 80s. But
well, Spawn, okay, actually, hang well, on. You know, talking to the expert, not the expert. You're talking to an expert.
An expert.
Later than that. Venom is from...
What I mean is McFarlane.
Right.
Comes along and he does Venom, and that's the late 80s, if I remember right.
Yeah, probably. I mean, again, if I was guessing, I'd say like 88, 89. Yeah,
I was going to say 88, thereabouts. But Deadpool's fairly recent by comparison. Well,
91.
91. Okay, so it's right around that era then.
Yeah, 91, because we were trying to see when his 25th anniversary would be, and I'm pretty sure it's 2016.
So my question to you then about Deadpool is, how did he suddenly come out of nowhere? It seems like only a few years ago did I start hearing about it, and suddenly he seems like the hottest property in comics.
Well, it comes in waves. I mean, Deadpool, like we said, he started in like 91 as a supporting character in X-Force comics, and he, you know, he had a little bit of a spark because he was, you know, funny, and he would make pop culture references, and he was kind of a badass, but he was, you know. But
it breaks the fourth wall occasionally, things like that. Well,
he did so much back then.
Okay.
But then he kind of was like, oh, people were like, oh, he's fun. Then he started getting his own miniseries for a while. He got a couple of miniseries that were pretty great and pretty exciting.
Mm-hmm.
And then in, oh gosh, what year was it? 93 maybe? That Joe Kelly, who was at the time pretty new to the comics industry, launched a Deadpool ongoing series. It is really, really great. They just came out with a Joe Kelly omnibus, Deadpool omnibus.
Okay.
Highly recommended. It's, you know, it's expensive because it's a big, thick hardcover.
Yeah, it's not like a softcover essentials.
Right. They do have Deadpool classics trades softcovers, which you get. But they just came out with the omnibus of Joe Kelly. Joe Kelly's run of Deadpool was terrific. It basically, I mean, I think that's what really defined the character as we've come to know him today. There were definitely spots of it in all the works before that. Absolutely. I'm not trying to denigrate anything that the other did. But Joe Kelly, I think...
Joe Kelly put all the elements together that created the one that really has taken off.
Right. And even then, it was... You know, it was touch and go popularity-wise. Like, apparently it was always in danger of cancellation back then. I wasn't working on it at the time. I was reading the comics. But from what I hear, it was always in danger of cancellation. And, you know, they were worried about this and that. They did some really great comics. After Joe Kelly left the comic, you know, there were some other great writers who wrote him. But he didn't – that's the one that most of the fans go, that was when it was the best. Then – Time goes on. He kind of cycled out of popularity a little bit. He at one point his book changed to being called Agent X, and it was a different character, but it was sort of based on him, and it was weird. It was a fun run, but it was different. And then for a while he didn't have a book at all. Then he was part of a book called Cable and Deadpool, which was like a team up book.
Okay.
And then when that one ended, again, nothing.
The spark wasn't there. People weren't digging on him.
Yeah. Those were some fun comics. Cable and Deadpool was a blast. Mm-hmm. It just wasn't selling. So they let him kind of lie low for a little while.
Okay.
And then when he came back, I don't know what the exact chemistry was, but it was something, I guess, if I had to guess, I would say it was something about the fact that comics were going through a real serious period.
And he brought back sort of a fun feel to it.
Right, exactly. Like, it was after Civil War, so the Marvel Universe was very angry and everybody was
split apart,
right. And so I think then he all of a sudden Deadpool pops up in an arc of Wolverine and is just fun. And
so he brings the people who are, you know, in their late 20s or 30s, it reminds them of why they may have gotten into comics as a kid.
You know what? And also at the same time, actually, now that I think about it, I think around that same time was the release of the video game of Ultimate Alliance.
Ooh, maybe.
Which he appears in. Do you know this game?
I'm aware of it, yeah.
He's a real fun character to play in that game. And
I wonder also if it might be things like Adult Swim and the culture shift. Because Adult Swim is really a groundbreaking set of programs.
Sure, sure.
In changing animation and humor.
I mean, yeah, the fact that, well, I mean, that's the, so there have been some Deadpool comics that lean more towards the humor and other ones that lean more towards the drama and some that try to do both. The most recent series, the one that I'm working on right now, is being co-written by Brian Posehn and Jerry Duggan, who are both comedians and are both.
I believe I know Brian Posehn was on, he's on one of my favorite animated shows that got canceled far too early, Mission Hill.
I'm not familiar with that one.
Oh, great series of my pants. Only like 10 episodes long. But if I remember right, Brian Posehn plays the best friend on the show. Okay. But it's brilliant series in my opinion. I love it. It's one of the ones I keep on the shelf next to the DVD of Clerks, the animated series.
Strong series,
I thought. A damn shame it only got canceled after 6. Especially if you listen to the commentary and they tell you the plots for some future episodes they never got to make.
Yeah, I love that show.
Brilliant.
My phone kind of annoyed. My text message sound is a sound of a clip from that of Randall just going.
My current ringtone for my wife actually is from Archer. It's Archer's ringtone. Mulatto Butts. So as soon as my phone starts ringing, it just starts screaming, Mulatto Butts, Mulatto Butts, and anyway.
But I was just. Brian and Jerry are super funny guys, so we launched with an arc that definitely leaned heavily into the humor. It's the first arc is a necromancer who believes that the United States has gotten off track, resurrects all the dead presidents of the United States of America. Unfortunately, they all come back evil, and so Deadpool gets tasked by S.H.I.E.L.D. to kill them all again.
Well, I could see some of that being hilarious. Like in the case of like Teddy Roosevelt, he would be a very big danger.
Mm-hmm.
But then I'm picturing like Millard Fillmore. Well, no, he would be badass because he is angry of what happened to his president. So I'm trying to picture like Warren Harding getting violent about it.
It was fun because in the first issue, before Deadpool even comes in the opening scene, who is it that? Oh. Captain America kills the first one, and I can't remember who it is now.
Chester A. Arthur.
No, it's someone he met in World War II, because I remember they said...
Eisenhower?
No, who's after Eisenhower?
Nixon?
No, okay, maybe. Who's before Eisenhower?
FDR? Truman?
Yeah, it was Truman.
Okay.
Captain America re-kills Truman. And then Deadpool in the first issue fights FDR. And in the second issue, Deadpool fights Teddy Roosevelt. And in the third issue, he fights Lincoln.
I was about to say, I can only picture him beating Lincoln.
Oh, no. In the third issue, he fights Nixon. Then he fights Lincoln. And in the fifth issue, we had to be like, he fights a zillion of them. Like, he kills a ton of them really quickly because we were taking way too long to get through them all.
Yeah, it would take what, 40 issues to get through it all plus, you know?
There's one scene where he's literally like, he literally says something like, sound off as I kill you. And he's like running panel to panel, chopping off their heads. Like, they're going like, I'm Warren Harding.
I'm Chester A. Arthur. Ah, you know,
there's a big naked Taft flying around in a spectral bathtub.
Oh, jeez,
very fun. And of course, Washington is the end boss.
Why have I not paid attention to comics for a while? I don't know. I got to get back into it. I think
highly recommend the first arc of Deadpool. And the thing is, now, like I said, that's a super jokey concept, obviously.
Right.
And we did lean into the humor just to kick it off. That being said, by the end of even just of that arc, a couple of things happen that are a little more like, whoa, wait, really? Did that happen? And then, you know,
and that's setting up future events.
Right. We kind of go back and forth between being really funny and being really, not really serious, but being dramatic as well. And I think we've struck a pretty good balance on that.
So we've been talking about Deadpool and everything, and that leads me to ask, what makes a good comic character, really? Like, is there a magic formula?
Well, no. I mean, you know, the way you can tell that there isn't is, unfortunately, is that Deadpool is kind of an amazing anomaly in that he and Cable are characters from around the early 1990s who are popular or have some degree of popularity still. Beyond that, who's the most recent character before that who is popular? And again, you're going to hit like Wolverine in the 70s and then before that and the other all new X-Men. And then again, before that, really the most of the popular characters are from the 60s. If we had the key
well,
to just
here's Gambit's in there too.
Yeah. Gambit's from the 80s and he's pretty popular. Although again, you know, he's like a lot of the X-Men characters are weird in that as a concept, the X-Men itself is like super popular.
Mm-hmm.
Very few of them can hold their own.
Yeah.
Like Gambit, they try giving him a series once in a while, and then it lasts for a little while, and then it tapers off.
Mm. Yeah, I can see not many of them holding as standalones. You know, I know Wolverine has, but again, that's a, you know, I almost feel like there's a lot of classical elements in terms of character design when it comes to Wolverine.
Sure, sure. I mean, I would say the things that matter most in a character are the classical heroes myth kind of stuff, you know, like
the man with a thousand faces,
right? I mean, you know, you probably want some degree of relatability. You probably want to make them have some degree of conflict in them. What's weird about, again though, what's weird about comic book characters versus your average hero of something is that on some level we want comic books to last forever.
Mm. Maybe so, that's why they don't die then.
Well, that's why they don't die, but also it's why they can't, on some level, they can't ever completely succeed either.
Mm.
Spider-Man, for example, is a character, right? What's it about? It's about, well, in many ways, it's rooted in the concept of youth. You know, in many ways, it's a coming of age story, but you know, it's about responsibility. It's about doing what's right. To me, anyway, Spider-Man always seems most like it's about doing what's right, even though it's not what's easy. Doing what's right, even sometimes at the expense of your own happiness or comfort. But
and isn't that exactly what the definition of hero is,
right,
almost, in fiction?
And on some level, Spider-Man can never come to terms with that.
Mm.
Because he has to constantly be kind of fighting that battle. You know what I mean?
If he does, the comic's over.
Right, exactly, exactly. I think if you find a character that has a compelling enough that you can use, let's say, as a compelling enough lens to tell different stories. Spider-Man is a great character because we've been able to tell.
And you haven't run out of stories with it.
Yeah, because you in a way it's like it's a lens through which you can show other stories. You can be like, okay, well, we're going to have it. We're going to have new villains are going to come in, and he's still going to be dealing with this stuff in his life.
Mm-hmm.
Things
he's
are going
to still married to Mary Jane. He still has to make money.
That is inaccurate. He's not married to Mary Jane.
I thought he was. He is in the newspaper one. Okay.
He got married. See, now this is actually a big debate. This is a big,
okay,
big hot button issue.
Uh oh.
I think it relates very much to what we're discussing right now.
Okay.
I'll try not to take too long because I know.
No, I'll trust you on this.
Okay. You mentioned that he's married in the strip. That is correct. That is why he got married in the comic. Stan Lee came to Marvel and Stan Lee said, I'm going to have him get married. And the comic company went, what? Whoa, what? You're going to have him get married? Like, that's a big deal. If he's going to get married there, he's got to get married in the, like, because that's huge. We don't want to let that, you know, idea by. At the time when
otherwise you're going to get a bunch of fanboys going, but in the comics, he's not very soon.
Well, not even just that. Just like it's a big media event. They don't want to lose.
They don't want to lose that chance. No.
So they said, we'll do it in both. We'll do it in both at the same time. At this moment when they made that decision, he wasn't even dating Mary Jane.
Mm.
But they went, okay, we're going to do this. So they threw it together. They made it happen.
Okay.
Pretty much ever since then, they've regretted it.
Why? I mean, I think that's a fine story, actually. Well, but then what do I know?
Not only have they always been running it, lots and lots, they've tried time and time again to undo it, to find a way to erase the marriage, or to unmarry him in various ways. Now, here's why.
Okay, why?
Like I said, in many ways, Spider-Man is about youth because it is about kind of learning things that young people learn. I think Steve Ditko, the co-creator of Spider-Man, said this. I think that's where I heard this quote, was someone quoted him saying it. But he said something to the effect of, if a young person messes up all the time, they're learning. If an adult messes up all the time, they're a loser.
no, that makes sense.
Quote, even if it was a Steve Ditko quote, I'm butchering it.
Okay. But that's
a general idea. So that's why you got to try to keep Spider-Man young. Now, first of all, I think as soon as he gets married, he gets older.
True.
Yes, some people get married young, including myself. I got married at 21.
But still.
It's not that common. And if you ask, and it did its damage. If you ask the average reader, how old is Spider-Man right now? You're probably going to get an answer that is higher than if you ask the editor of Spider-Man, how old is Spider-Man right now?
Yeah, and then with reboots and everything, when they did Ultimates, they kicked him back to what he was like 15 again.
The other reason, so part of it is because it ages him. And then regarding getting rid of it, if you divorce him, that makes him even older. And if you widow him, again, that also like ages him. So what they ended up doing was they used magic and they erased it. I don't want to get into that.
Okay, let's just leave it at that. But it basically the damage was done.
The other reason it's a bad idea, in my opinion, and I grew up with Spider-Man married.
Mm-hmm.
I was in love with Mary Jane. I wasn't in love with her. I loved her.
No, I know what you mean.
I was very fond of her. I was like, oh my God, she's great. She would be great to
she's
have.
She's a great character. You know, they should be married, blah, blah, blah.
I'm sure I had a crush on her. And I loved their relationship. But much later, I saw people arguing about this, and I was totally swayed the other direction to, you're right, it was a mistake. Here's why.
All right.
If Mary Jane is his wife, it helps Peter's problems. It does not cause more problems. Now, I know that's a simplistic view and that in real life, marriage is work and things
like
that.
No, but you're right, actually.
Because
she can help him and give him advice, and she can interfere in things for the positive thing.
Right. If Aunt May is going, where is Peter? Mary Jane can lie for him.
And she can spend time with Mary. She can go over to Aunt May's house and take care of her, and then Peter doesn't have to worry.
All these things. Because she's a good, supportive wife. Now, the other option is you could make her not be supportive of Spider-Man, which makes her horrible.
Which makes her a horrible person, and yes. People don't like her.
Right. Neither of those is really a very good idea.
And then you get some fanboy going, well, why couldn't she have died off the Brooklyn Bridge and had her neck snapped?
And every once in a while, they would toy with the idea that maybe she's being neglected. But then, as a reader, you have to go, he's saving lives, woman. What are you doing? You want him to not save lives so he can spend time with you? And on some level, it just makes her look bad. It's just better if they're not married. If they're not married, they can always have break up and it's fine.
It sounds to me like you could sustain it for a few episodes, a couple arcs or whatever, but eventually you can't sustain that relationship.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's a kind of almost a what if. It's like, what if they were married and we can explore that for a bit, but then eventually we've got to remember what this really the core of this comic is about.
To turn it slightly across town to DC, I actually think as much as I don't think Spider-Man's marriage was a good idea, I think it's even worse back when they had Superman married.
Why is that?
Because it got rid of I felt like it got rid of some of who Superman was. If you look at the old Superman comics, and I mean old, like 50s,
okay,
you'll frequently see comics about Lois Lane being in love with Superman, right, and wanting to marry Superman.
Right.
She does not want to marry Clark Kent. She doesn't know he's Superman, obviously. There's always tricks that are played on her. But she literally wants to marry Superman. Like, they're not thinking about Superman as a guy with a secret identity for the most part. They're thinking his name is Superman. He lives up in the North Pole. And if I were to marry him, he would show up in his cape and a priest would say, do you Superman take him, me, her, off the wedded wife? Now, that's a silly idea. But at the same time, when they actually had them get married, it was because she found out his secret. She knew he was Clark Kent. She accepted him for who he was. Again, removing problems. He no longer has to hide from her. He can be really comforting. And then again, he goes out and he's fighting and she's like, I'm worried about him, but he's Superman. I can't give him any grief. Oh, he's going to miss our dinner. Well, he's Superman. He's saving the world.
And besides, if he misses dinner, he can just turn the sun back and turn the earth back around and we can have dinner again anyway.
And then she would whisper, it's all right, Clark. I understand. And he'd hear it thousands of miles away and go, good. I feel good about things. Like, it was just all comfort.
It basically feeds then into the idea that, it basically feeds back into the idea that Superman is a dick. You know? Let me ask you, Jordan, real quick here about this, because I'm thinking of, like, I mentioned the fans earlier. What interaction do you have with the fans of these books and such? Do they know who you are?
Some of them, yeah. I mean, I'm up on Twitter, and my Twitter is at Crackshot, except with the zero instead of an O, which is not my own name, because I'm dumb, and I've had it for a while now.
Yeah.
but yeah, there's a number of comic fans who know I'm on there, and feel free if you're a comics fan to follow me, or even if you're not.
Yes, bother him with anal questions about things.
Well, not always, but they, you know, they'll talk to me about that. I go to conventions sometimes, and I'll see people there. We do get fan mail, you know, reader mail, whatever you want to call it. officex@marvel.com.
Mm-hmm. Do you guys still have like a letter to the editor column in
Deadpool? We do. Deadpool answers it himself.
Oh, okay.
Always fun, and usually written by Brian or Jerry.
We'll just say that you know, he actually writes it. You know,
of course. I mean,
illusion there.
And then in addition, there's a show I go to every week, or pretty much every week, called Comic Book Club.
Okay.
It's a comic book podcast. Records live here in New York, and the guys who run it, I became friends with them by going to the show, because I enjoyed it and I would go to it, and I became friends with them, and I tend to go there and watch it every week, and a lot of times I'll talk to, if people recognize me, which once in a while they do, I'll talk about stuff there, which is always a lot of fun.
I would think that you're getting more recognized because you got involved with the Marvel's AR thing that they do now online, and they do a lot of videos and things. Like, I know a couple of years ago you voiced Howard the Duck. in a little skit poking fun at him not getting an anniversary nod from Marvel.
That's true.
How did you get involved doing that stuff with them?
Well, those ones, the what if, or no, not what if, I'm sorry, the videos that they do with those action figures, there's like a group of guys who do that for the website, and they'll come to us editors or other people in the company and say, hey, do you want to do a voice? And I'm always like, sure. I kind of wish I had done more voices for them. I've done Howard. I did, at one point I did Venom, which was very, I thought, an odd choice, but I was like, all right. I did Beast a couple times. That was fun.
I see you playing Beast. Yeah.
But that was just stuff for the website directly. The AR stuff was more recent, and they developed this AR app, and then they came to us came to all the editors and said, we want to put this AR stuff in the books. You know, do you guys have ideas for it? What kind of ideas do you have? And basically, as soon as they came up with it, they sort of went, do it. Just start doing it.
We got to get on this mobile stuff that the kids are using these days.
And we just immediately started. And so I've done a bunch of stuff on there. I've done a bunch of voice things. I've done many. I do the voice of the recap of Thor every time, which is like, the mighty Thor has trekked across Asgard. I don't know what, I don't have any script here.
No.
That's fun to do. And then we've done like silly ones. Like we did some, sometimes we'll have the panels get animated a little bit, just a little bit, kind of like Archer.
Okay. Level. Yeah.
And we'll have them talk and be funny. And I also have had Scape in videos a few times, not my actual cat, but the character of my cat
that you do on your podcast,
right, on my podcast as well. Yes, that's a lot of fun to do.
Yeah, I've noticed that. How are the fans reacting to this new AR stuff? Because this is pretty recent.
Some of it they like, and some of it they absolutely hate. I mean, the
comic fans are fickle, aren't they?
Oh yeah, the Scape videos tend to do all right, and some of the funny animations do well. Some of those I've seen some good responses for. We recently just wrapped a series of 10 parts called As the Page Turns, which is kind of an editorial behind the scenes, but really comedy sketches.
Mm-hmm.
And it has an ongoing plot of 10 episodes in which, in the first episode, John Moyson, who is an assistant editor, is going to pitch a story to an editorial meeting, and they open the great book of Marvel, which has all the stories that we have ever or will ever publish in it, so that they can consult it and see if the story's in there.
So it's like a fictionalized docudrama then, basically. Right.
Well, yeah, I mean, except super silly.
Exactly, super silly about it.
And all the pages have gone blank. And so it becomes a mystery of what happened to the book, but a silly mystery. And
well, there you go. You got rid of Mary Jane and Peter Parker ever getting married.
There you go. There you
never
go.
Never happened.
And we actually just, I think the first 9 episodes are up on, well, they're probably, by the time this airs, I'm sure all 10 of the episodes will be up on the Marvel YouTube channel. But in episode 9, we find out who the culprit is.
So it's a very important one. Then we won't give any spoilers then. So folks that want to check this out, they can go just to Marvel's YouTube channel.
Yep, Marvel's YouTube channel. Or if you search for Marvel As the Page Turns, you'll find probably the videos specifically, and probably even a playlist. I know I've got a playlist made up of all the episodes so far.
Awesome. I hope some people check it out. Jordan, we're past an hour, man. Time just flew by here, man.
Yeah, I had a lot of fun.
I did too. It's great having you on here. We didn't even get to talk about a lot of things. We didn't even talk about your podcast that much or your music, because you're very involved with the ukulele.
Yeah, I played a lot.
and much more.
If you'd like, I can tell people where they can find all that stuff.
Yeah, I was just about to ask. So people can find you on Twitter at crackshot with the letter O replaced with a zero.
Correct.
They can find the Marvel AR stuff, including As the Page Turns, they can find on the Marvel YouTube channel.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. My podcast is called Cast in Wax, and it has in it all the radio serials that we did when we were in college are part of it.
Yes, folks can find my early stuff there when Charlton Heston and I were were symbiotic.
As Charlton Heston quite a few times. But in addition to that, it also every episode has new frame segments and new characters and new bits, and then up nowadays we're out of all the old college ones, so we have all new radio serials done by various friends of ours. So that's Cast in Wax, and you can find that on iTunes and stuff like that. And if you search for me on YouTube, you can search my YouTube page is also called Cast in Wax, and I have, I don't know, 60 70 80 videos of me playing the ukulele. I do lots and lots of ukulele covers. I have a lot of fun doing them, and people seem to say I'm pretty decent at it.
And I enjoyed a couple of your covers there. I listened to your 25 years your callback one that you did of
the third.
The what?
The 33 and a third?
The project? 33 and a third set. And,
you, my friend.
That was a fun one to listen to your covers.
You inspired that.
I did?
Because you were the first person I ever heard say the idea of doing something to celebrate their 33 and a third birthday.
Oh, that's true. Yeah. I haven't given up that idea, by the way, of getting a tattoo.
You should do it.
I haven't just, you know, I'm past my 33 and a third now, but I do have another goal in life that I'm going to aim for.
But that stuck in my head. And so what he was referring to, just so everybody knows, I did an album of on my 33 and a third birthday, I released an album on Bandcamp of 12 songs from 1979, one from each month, a number one hit from each month of the year. couple of which I had literally never heard before I started this project.
I looked at the track list and I knew every single one of them. I'm better than you.
Birth song.
That's true.
The song that was number one when I was born, Babe by Styx, I had never heard before I started.
Babe, I'm leaving.
Yep, that's it.
I don't know any other lines. Oh, it could be worse. Mine was right around then, and mine was Chic, Les Freak.
Yeah,
that was my birth song. Now you're on Bandcamp as well?
Yes, Bandcamp. If you search for Jordan D. White, I'll come up, and I've got that. All my stuff on Bandcamp is totally free. Feel free to download it. It's fun.
Excellent. Well, Jordan, it has been a pleasure talking to you, man. We should have you back on sometime, man.
Sure, anytime.
Anytime, man. It has been great talking with you. Best of luck, and I guess maybe a few more listeners now will be heading to the local comic shop to see if they can find you.
Let's hope I sold.
And see, and maybe you sold a little bit of your product there. Not that you were actually shilling or anything there. But thanks a lot for being here, man. Really appreciate it.
Absolute pleasure.
Take care, man.
The SAFTAcast is a production of the Sundress Academy for the Arts. For episodes and more, visit SAFTAcast.com. Until we talk again, this is your host, Scott C., signing off.